Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. Hey, everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right. Join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's going to be there. Phil the Engineer is going to be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, Wild Game Recipes for the Grill, Smoker, Camp Stove, and Camp Fire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th, the Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25th, the Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27th, the Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29, the Union in Salt Lake City. April 30, the Egyptian in Boise. May 1, the Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2, the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at the Meat Eater. com. Hope to see you at the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Hunting Collective. I'm Ben O'Brien. And this week, we're joined by the great Shane Mahoney. And if you don't know who Shane Mahoney is, stop now and go back to episode number 5 of the Hunting Collective, almost a year ago now, and listen to that episode. Because what that episode will do is color a little bit of who he is, where he came from, some of the important aspects of his early life, and some of his overall philosophies about what we do. What I wanted this conversation to be, and it turned out to be a pretty prolific one, is to be specifically breaking down the North American model of wildlife conservation. And if you don't know about that model, hopefully you do already understand what it is. It's a set of principles that was introduced by Dr. Valerius Geist and Shane Mahoney himself and some others back originally in 1988, but it as Shane will describe, gained steam throughout the following decades. And it's really the principles that guide wildlife management and conservation in the U.S. and in Canada. And it's important. I've referenced it on this podcast many times. I've talked about it on other podcasts and larger platforms many times. And I feel as though this conversation is seminal to how we think about ourselves and our influence on the natural world and the way that we manage that influence and the way that we achieve sustainability in all of these things that we do. So that's what we talked about. We went through the history. Shane has a unique history with the North American model. There's some anecdotes and stories in here that I doubt anyone will ever have heard about how it was conceived and how it was marketed and promoted and normalized. And I'm very excited to have this podcast be where those are seen. So we've broken this up into two episodes. This first episode we'll get into the history of the North American model and some of the more important tenets. And then next week, next Tuesday, more will come then. But for now, please listen to the first part of our wonderful conversation on the North American model of wildlife conservation with Shane Mahoney. Shane Mahoney, how's it going?
Really well. Here in Bozeman, Montana, enjoying the cold sunshine. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I find that like people will complain about the cold, but I find that there's a lot of cold days here. There's blue sky.
Oh, beautiful.
And the mountains are, you know, towering above you, and the sun is out. It's, even if it's -5, it still feels wonderful.
I love it here, man. I love it. I don't mind the cold.
You make it here often? I know you've been here a couple times recently.
Yeah, no, I make it to Montana fairly often because I've done a lot of things in this state. I mean, I work with the Elk Foundation, did a lot of things with them over the years. I mean, it was in this state that we filmed The Opportunity for All, the first full exposition of the North American model. That's been so widely distributed. You know, I did television shows, hosted and narrated Boone and Crockett's television show for 7 years, and they're based in Missoula. And now I have a lot of partnerships that are resting in the state in Missoula, still with Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation as a major partner. But here in Bozeman, I have the Wild Sheep Foundation and Sitka Gear, Mystery Ranch, et cetera. So, you know, it's kind of become a little bit of a hub state for me in a sense, you know. And plus, it's absolutely glorious here. So
that it is.
And I've hunted elk here in the past, and I've done some fishing here, and I most likely will be back to hunt elk again this fall.
Great. Well, I don't want to leave the people waiting. I want to get into one of the reasons I wanted to chat with you this time. If you're interested in Shane's background, go back and listen to, I believe, episode 5 that you and I did. Oh, it had to be a year ago now.
Yeah.
It does go back into, you know, how you grew up and your life in Canada and in Newfoundland. And a lot of people have made comments to me in the preceding year that was very interesting, that they'd never heard you speaking like that. So go back to episode 5, listen to that. But I want to get into, in as much depth as we possibly can, a couple of things here. But the first one is, well, you already mentioned it, the North American model of wildlife conservation. It's been something that's come up for me a lot recently, come up for our world a lot recently, as we get challenged from without, you know, within our group. It's something that we've used to push back on. We have this model of conservation. It's been codified, and I've heard it described as kind of a look back to the history of conservation in North America, you know, hat tip back to the history of conservation, but also a way to look forward as well.
Mm-hmm.
In the same vein. So I want to go through that and maybe start at the beginning. And what, you know, take us back to the first time you heard this term, you know, where you were and how it started to become what it became eventually when it was launched.
Well,
I tend to ask very long questions.
That's quite all right. I tend to give long answers. So between us, we'll chew up the time.
Yes, we will.
But first of all, a lot of people, when they hear the term, and even people who use the term frequently, feel or believe that this is a very old term, and that somehow that term was around ever since the movement, if you will, for conservation began, and that's just completely untrue. The term entered the English language around 1988. Before that time, no one had ever used this term because no one had ever attempted to come up with a moniker or a title, if you will, for the system of institutions, policies, and laws and organizations that collectively form the model or the operational approach to conservation in North America. And it was first coined, the term, by a man, a very, very close friend and mentor of mine, Dr. Valerius Geist. And why did he feel it necessary, or what motivated him to come up with the term, was at that time, there was a growing investment on the part of some people in this idea of capturing and maintaining in captive circumstances wildlife in Canada and in the United States, the whole game ranching, game farming industry, which has had its share of notoriety, a considerable percentage of which has been very justly deserved. And Geist, and amongst some others, and of course I was drawn into it as a friend and student with him, pointed out the amazing risks, uncertainties, and unknowns, as well as the known problems associated with keeping wildlife in captive circumstances, selectively breeding them, and doing all of the things that eventually form the basis of the game ranching business in our two countries. And in particular, we were warning, and he was warning, about the problems of a disease transfer between wild
yes.
and the captive animals. And not just the diseases that we knew, but it has been a pattern over historical time that under captive circumstances, for many reasons, some of which are not well known, novel diseases arise. And so while he was not predicting a CWD problem, a chronic wasting disease problem, in specifics, he was predicting essentially that phenomenon.
The creation of that environment.
Yes.
Per se. Right.
And so in these debates, which became very much very intense, there were critics of his who kept coming back and saying, well, so what? You know, what's at risk in it? And at one point he said, the entire model of conservation in North America is at risk. And they responded, what model? There is no
what model
is out there. And of course, this turned Geist to his computer, where he smacked out, you know, the first real peer-reviewed academic publication on the model. And that, too, is interesting because people have to understand that what's now in general parlance or general discussion amongst us all as hunters, non-hunters, state agency personnel, politicians, etc., did in fact come out of the academic literature. And then I began the effort of popularizing this, bringing it to American audiences and talking about it a great deal. I did that first in 1993 in Green Bay, Wisconsin, at a governor's symposium, and virtually no one in the audience had ever heard of the North American model. And through a group of colleagues who worked with me, eventually that I met in this country, we started taking sort of a workshop to the state agencies in the United States of America. And out of those state agencies and presentations at conferences, we eventually got this term, first of all, floating out through the discussion that was taking place around North America. And suddenly people realized the value of having a conceptual basket that you could carry it around with. And instead of having to talk about all those individual pieces, you could say the model. And people would understand exactly what you meant.
Yeah, and you can number. You have a numbered list of tenets and things that.
There were essentially seven principles.
Do you believe? You know, I've read a lot about the subject, and you know, in the last couple of years, as it's become important to my understanding of what we do in conservation, or my general understanding of the historical principles, you know, and really. An ethical prescription for the future of conservation too at some level this becomes. But a lot of people will say it didn't really come to be articulated until the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Is that the way that, you know, I know you say like in smaller pockets that you start to grow it.
It took about a decade, so that would be right. It took about a decade for us to really bring it. I mean, I personally was speaking at every event you could possibly name to talk about this. We had, in some cases, four and five state agencies coming together to attend the two-day workshops that we would give on this. We had organizations like the Elk Foundation and the National Wild Turkey Federation that helped sponsor some of those. We had individual state agencies, such as Arizona, when Duane Schroff was director, inviting me in to simply speak to all his staff, everybody from administrative personnel right up the line around this. And that happened on many occasions. And then, of course, you know, others picked it up, and they began to talk about it in their agencies, and then they became knowledgeable of it, and they went elsewhere and spoke about it. But it's a very interesting point historiographically, and from the point of view of having influence. We took a term. I happen to know the man who invented it, and I knew the history of why it came to be. Not very many people will have ever heard that history that we've just shared on your podcast, but that's what happened. But we were able to take it without money, without an organization behind us, without any kind of beautifully laid out plan, just by sheer passion and commitment in recognizing the value of this idea, you know, I gave years to essentially marketing, if you will, the term.
Yeah.
And now it's out there.
Right? It is. And we were talking the other day about, I think the same room, we talk about timeliness, right? And, you know, serving up your message when it's being when it's ready to be heard.
Yep.
So what do you think this, what do you think during that time? I mean, obviously we just discussed that it spans, you know, roughly a 12-year period there, 15-year period until it really got codified and articulated in the public sense of that. What do you feel like it says about that, generally, that decade in conservation? Where was the conservation world? It's obvious to me that it says that they were desperate to see this outlined. In some way, or maybe they didn't even know that they needed it, but when they heard it, they knew it was a solution to a problem. So kind of take people through where you feel like the progression of conservation was during that time.
Well, I think both things you say are true. I mean, I think both those things are often true generally. There can be a community of interest for an idea that are not aware that they need it, but as soon as they see it, they say, oh, of course, that makes perfect sense. There was also, however, at that time, in the 1980s, it was really when we started to see the explosion of this whole idea of game ranching. And exotics being moved in and out. It was not only resident or indigenous or native wildlife that was being incorporated. People were talking about bringing all kinds of exotics in. And it was happening in a way that was also tied to large money and big agriculture, in the sense, bigger, you know. And that opened up a series of conflicts that still reside in this debate space. Conflicts over, okay, who owned them now? When wildlife is on the land, the state agency, the state government has the responsibility to them, or the provincial government under the public trust doctrine, which is a principle of the model. And that has been upheld in court. Well, once you transpose those wild animals into fenced enclosures, began to feed them and inoculate them and do all the things you have to do when you confine animals in a small space, suddenly, you know, debates started to arise over, well, who owned them? Could these not be private property? Were they not private property? And of course, this cracked open a very big conceptual debate, which was absolutely foundational to the future of conservation and all utilization of wildlife by consumptive users, certainly.
Sure.
That, oh, maybe there was now going to be two kinds of wildlife. There was going to be the public's wildlife, and then there's going to be the private citizen's wildlife.
Yeah. And how do we you know, judge the transfer between those two?
Yes.
You know,
I mean, that's a complicated thing.
Yes.
And it also is a complicated thing mechanistically, as you point out, and legalistically, which would involve, you know, which government departments were responsible, agriculture or the wildlife agency, et cetera, et cetera. But it also tapped into, of course, one of the foundational quiet but deeply held beliefs, views, and hopes and values of American and Canadian society, which was and has always been that wildlife is owned by no one except all of us collectively. And this is one of those things that, you know, we can look to where the public doesn't go around every day thinking about this. But should you challenge it, suddenly they start to think about it pretty seriously. It would be akin to saying to the American public today, we have decided to privatize all the national parks. And, you know, even though not everybody is screaming every day about national parks in this country, pretty soon people would stand
We're going to fence off a part of Yellowstone, and those animals will now belong to a certain person or subset of individuals.
Yeah. So it really cracked open that kind of foundational debate. And therefore, that too was part of the motivation for clarifying, hold on, we have a system. And it's been very successful, and it's been based on these kinds of principles, and private ownership of wildlife was not one of them. So we're not going there. And this became a very vitriolic debate. I mean, there were death threats, and there were a lot of things. This became a, long before it was as intense in the United States, it was viciously intense in Canada.
Yeah.
And eventually became viciously intense in a lot of places. And it's only last year that the government of Missouri, you know, finally decided that, you know, wildlife under private or captive circumstances remained the responsibility of the wildlife agency and was not going to be transferred to agriculture and treated, you know, fundamentally differently. So the debate still rages over this.
Yeah, and I think it, when these fundamental changes occur, or these happenings in our world occur that result in this need for fundamental change or a fundamental shift, it has to take many years for it to settle in, and you know, especially the way our, you know, the model, you know, prescribes state-run management.
Yep.
Every state, every region, you know, some, I'm sure there are some states, I'm not sure if this is true or not, but there may still be some states in this country where there are very few or none at all high fence properties that have privatized wildlife.
That is true.
I lived in a state of Texas where there it is part of the culture at this point.
Yes.
In a large way. So, I mean, it's with those varying values across the board, it's hard to kind of lock that down and codify that.
Yeah. It is true. And of course, what it also remarks, I think, is that, you know, our debates over wildlife and whether even something that superficially might not seem that significant, you know, so some animals are going to be held behind fences, can unleash really fundamental outpourings of expression and concern on the part of people and institutions, which, if you think about it, is evidence for the fact that we really did have a model. We really did have principles. We really did have institutions, right? And systems of laws and so on that we had developed over time to safeguard wildlife and to safeguard human engagements with it under a prescribed set of values, ethics, and moral compass bearings that, in general, remain acceptable to people. There were, of course, critics. I mean, I could name you even some high-profile personalities in the conservation world today who said to me when I first started this in the 1990s, "What model? We don't have a model." And they kind of, you know, dismissed it as though the model is what they kind of personally carry around with them, right? but in the end, we succeeded massively. And fortunately, in September of this year, Thalgeist and I will come out now with the first full edited volume book devoted to the North American model.
Yeah.
Which I believe was...
It only took 32 years, Shane.
Yeah, that's all. In the meantime, there's been a lot of writing about it.
There has.
But this book will really bring it together. It's an effort to create a compendium, very carefully chosen in terms of the chapters and so on, that a new student coming in, if they wanted to know what is this thing they talk about, this North American model, they can go and they can understand it.
A huge resource. I feel, and I think you and I have talked about this before, but I feel that we don't have enough of that for, you know, it doesn't even have to be new. It could be any hunter or angler who is wondering about the history, about how all these models became to be, whether you would just talk specifically about not even like the Pittman-Robertson excise tax model. Like just that as a model of what that does. I mean, it's taken form in Dingell Johnson, and I think should probably take form in other ways in our world.
It probably will.
And surely it will, because it seems to work.
Yeah.
There's some parts in the Land and Water Conservation Fund where we're pulling monies from offshore drilling and putting them into conservation work. So I think there's a model there, a principle there that maybe hasn't been articulated that could be, but I'm immensely glad that you and Professor Geist have done that, because it is needed, and it's something that I wonder. Another thing I wanted to ask about,
if I could just interject, I think this is one of the really interesting things when we come out with this book will be how well it is taken up and how well it is circulated.
Sure.
4 years ago, I finished two monographs for the International Journal of Environmental Studies, on the role of hunting specifically in conservation in North America. This is the largest collection. It's about 25 peer-reviewed papers out of a European journal that is largely leftward-leaning in most of its politics. It's very much an environmental journal, but they, you know, they have published these two monographs. And I thought when we published those two monographs, or I did, that, boy, people will really want to take them up, because here you have in one, you know, two little volumes, you have the information on the recovery of wildlife, specific case studies for species, why it happened, how it happened, the funding mechanisms, everything of that nature around hunting. Yet there has been very, very little interest or pickup on those things. Mm. And yet with those two volumes and this new book, as I said, you could have a student coming into this program in early university or college who would have what it has taken me 40 years to sort of compile, yeah. You know, yeah. They would have it there. And the hope there was that this would be really taken up and really utilized by laymen, by professionals, by academics, and so on. So here's a challenge here now for your podcast. You know, maybe this this new system here and the whole meat eater machine and so on and so forth might be quite helpful as a vehicle yeah. to help get this out.
I know? Hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. 'Cause again, I love... I love the idea, you know, I'm not sure if you guys put it out or it's just been picked up over time, that is this reflection on the history of hunting and conservation and yep. how those things came to be known as parallel at the very least.
Yep.
But also this prescription toward the future as if to say, like, we're currently in what I would say the heyday of success for this model.
Yep.
It's kind of weaved its way in and out of these generations and these decades and remained
yep.
all relevant.
True. All true.
And I feel like that's an important thing to me. And yep. to think of it, and if somebody takes one thing out of this podcast going forward, is to think of the model in that way.
Yep.
Think of it as a look back, but also a prescription forward. Mm-hmm. And that's something very recently that I've come to understand, and that's what I think makes it so yeah. important.
And what happens there in terms of your point about going forward, Ben, you know, what happens if that isn't workable for the future?
Yeah.
And what are the alternatives that will be workable? Are there any? What do they look like? I mean, we really are at a time where many... many pieces of evidence force us to think about this, right?
Yeah, and we've talked about that some recently over yep. some bourbon at the Wild Sheep Show and yeah. elsewhere. Yep.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meat eater. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
But I also think my other personal opinion on this is that it's important to have a starting point. If we are going to change the model or be, you know, forced to, or just by happenstance of the way society interacts with wildlife, if we feel the need to shift it,
yeah,
which I'm sure we will.
Yeah, of course.
In the short term or the long term.
Yep.
Or both. Have a place to start and yep. have an agreed upon place to start. Like, this is what's working now. There's seven tenants. Do we need to add some, take some away? Do we, are, you know, some of these tenants in this model maybe not so effective in the way that they're being undertaken right now across the state level or however we would say, however we would tackle that. But it's important to have a place from which we start.
Yep.
And I think, you know, just hearing that, you know, some of the things you just said, I didn't know at all about the history of it, I think is huge for people to understand where this came from and how it was born out. And the fact that we're dealing with CWD outbreaks all over the country,
it's
a huge topic in our world.
It is.
And, you know, Val Geist was thinking of this idea when he was thinking of this model.
He was. And of course, he's been proven, unfortunately, he has been proven deadly accurate in his forecasts.
Yes.
And, you know, we should also float another cautionary tale. The appearance of this rather strange disease, chronic wasting disease, which we now have found in Norway and South Korea and various other places. So this is moving its way, but it originated here and it originated in this country, right? Mm-hmm. It originated in a state not far from here and so on. This does not mean that we finally set the boogeyman free, because there could be many other things which we are not aware of that are taking place in that disease cauldron that captive wildlife can create. And so while we ponder the implications of what a massive expansion of chronic wasting disease across wider ranges of the species could mean, while we ponder what it would be, what it would implicate or insinuate if we found that that disease would jump easily to people, we might also reflect on the fact that as long as we maintain these animals in captive circumstances, we run the risk of brand new problems that have not yet emerged.
Yeah, like we were saying earlier, I mean, it creates this environment. Who knows what the outcomes of this, the creation of that environment are, but it's there. It's kind of always on, always on.
It was very interesting. Just one small little further point on that. When I was in charge of wildlife research in Newfoundland and Labrador, we had a strong push then, because every province was being faced with it, as many states were, ideas from local entrepreneurs to raise captive whatever was made sense in that location. And they wanted to bring in, they wanted to ranch caribou, for example, and I was deadly opposed to this. And they brought in experts from New Zealand, where a lot of this work, you know, had happened long time before, veterinarians and others, and came and had a big debate with the provincial government in Newfoundland and our biologist, myself, and so on included. And I remember one of the things that really tipped over the conversation, because they were forceful in their expression that, you know, we can contain these problems, you know, we have the best veterinarians, we look after the animals, all those things being true, was just before they came to Newfoundland. I was well connected in the literature, and Geist and I were constantly, you know, streaming through the literature looking for problems that were emergent. And just before they came for those meetings in Newfoundland, a strange disease had broken out that was developing lesions on the faces of captive red deer in New Zealand. And they had never seen it before, even though they'd had these animals in captivity and were, you know, selling venison as it's marketed, you know, around the world.
To this day.
To this day, And I brought this up in the discussion, I remember, and they didn't expect us to know about it. And of course, the disease was too young for anyone to know exactly what was happening. But it was just another example of how even long-term practices with animals in captivity can continue to generate novel diseases over time.
Yeah. You may have just answered that with some of that reflection, but was there a time where you know, from the time that you first, you know, started discussing what this model was and it kind of rising in your mind, that you realized how important it was? Was there a moment that you remember specifically, or a group, series?
I do very, very well. I mean, there was, and it was instantaneous. Because when I first read that first paper, and of course I knew that paper was coming out because Geist and I were already sort of together. You know, we were talking about things and many, many, many things that he and I talked about. And it just struck me as soon as you had this kind of portable, conceptual little library with you now, you didn't have to reach for thoughts and considerations in a discussion or an argument to prove a point or to try and explain why something should matter in conservation. All of a sudden, you could open this little box up, and there in the theater, you know, as the curtain moved out, you saw on the stage all the players, the institutions, the policies, yeah, the laws, the funding mechanisms, you know, the idea that wildlife belongs to everyone, the application of science and expertise. You saw it all there, and you could simply look at it as you were sort of explaining that world to somebody. You could do it in a way that the narrative was logical, it was concise, it was contained, and the principles that were embedded in it were, of course, principles that matter to everyone. So for me, it was virtually instantaneous. I remember the discussions with Dr. Geist at the time saying, you know, normally what happens in a peer-reviewed publication in an academic journal, you might have a readership of 30, 40, 50, 70 people, honestly.
Yeah.
For those of you involved in podcasts and those in social media, they seem such ridiculous numbers. You ask yourself, why would anyone do it? Now, they have other impacts. But my concern, and I was right in that concern, was that if we didn't find a way to sort of take the show on the road with this idea, that it ran the risk of simply being embedded and somebody picking it up 10 years later and say, you know, there was an article published 10 years ago by a guy, Geist, and it's referred to this. I was convinced instantly that what was needed was a roadshow. And I started the roadshow. And I started the roadshow in Green Bay, Wisconsin, at the Governor's Symposium on Hunting and Fishing in 1993, when I was my first real invitation to come and speak in the United States, and I laid it on and that evening. And from that very day, there started a process of people in that audience who came up to me after, people in the Turkey Federation, people who became very close friends and colleagues of mine over time. And we collectively and independently took that show on the road, and that's why we're having this conversation today.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. And it's, you know, a relatively, we're not talking 50 years ago here. I mean, we're in the middle of the creation of this thing, I really feel. I mean,
sure.
Like you say, your book will come out soon.
Yeah.
So it was obviously just by that fact, we're in the middle of the story being written here.
Yes, we are.
It's not like we can look back, and it's not the turn of the century where we can say, you know, the first conferences or the first this, first that. We're still, you know, close to the first time this is really, you know, I would say put out there in a way that can be consumed by everybody for all time.
Yeah,
in that book. Well, let's break down some of the tenets here, because I think we were talking before that I was on Joe Rogan's podcast when we started to break down these tenets. We were talking about all kinds of subjects.
As is often the case.
As is often the case there. I think we got to Batman or something. Somehow in here got to Batman.
Well, maybe we need Batman.
Maybe we get Batman in here.
We need
10 and 8.
We need superheroes.
Batman. But, you know, even though we didn't really go through it in detail, the reaction from so many non-hunters when we went through these tenets on his podcast, which is a huge reach, obviously, was amazing. People were like, I didn't know that these thoughts were organized. I didn't know that this was I didn't know what I thought what you were talking about was bullshit, but it seems like because it's organized in this way and they all the all these things are relatable and functional.
Yeah.
That you hunters have thought this thing out.
Yeah.
You know, you conservationists have thought this thing out. Hunting is a huge part of what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what propelled me to want to, you know, to continue to break this down as a hunter who is somebody who has to, who is entrusted at some level with going out in the public and talking about what we do. I feel like probably there's a lot of hunters that have no idea or very little idea about how these tenants were formed and then how they, you know, were listed in the way that they're listed.
Yeah.
So let's start with the first one. I don't think you feel like we should read them all first and then go through them or just go through them one at a time. What's the best way to?
Maybe just go through them one at a time so we don't expect people to remember this big list, you know. This is is painful enough to listen to. We don't want to make it any more difficult for them.
We should have had a whiskey. It would have been more entertaining. You're just lean back and get educated here, people. This is what we're going to try. The first one is wildlife as a public trust resource.
Yeah.
Take us through the thought process with that.
Well, of course, leaving aside the Native Americans for whom, in fact, the resource was always treated as a public trust, even though it may not have been codified, that was how they approached wildlife, obviously. The European colonizers or the European immigrants that came to the United States and to Canada, for that matter, in the periods, you know, of the early 1500s and 1497 in Newfoundland's case, and then the colonies that started to appear in places like Cupid's in Newfoundland in 1610, Jamestown, and so on and so forth in the United States. As that movement began to take hold, of course, there was a reality clash that occurred that we can only imagine. These people coming from the difficult circumstances of Europe that in many cases involved landscapes that had been massively changed, living in urban environments of great filth and circumstances of great deprivation for many of them in many, many ways. And they were seeking freedom from a lot of things, including religious persecution and other things. And they all of a sudden landed upon the shores of this extraordinary, massive place that they could not even imagine the contours of. It was so massive. And it it thrived with wildlife of all kinds in the oceans and the streams on the land and so on. And, you know, they therefore were faced with this incredible bounty that they had never witnessed before, as well as meeting cultures that they had never known existed. And they had come, however, from political systems, many of them, in which degrees of privilege to one extent or another, sometimes extreme, in terms of ownership of wildlife, lay in the hands of wealthy, with private citizens, and wealthy citizens in particular, and in many cases, of course, in the hands of reigning monarchs, who basically in for many centuries in various parts of Europe essentially absconded to themselves the right, the only rights. And so this was a circumstance now where suddenly nobody owned anything, really. They didn't even own the land as they saw it, leaving aside, again, the tragic story of the Native American. And so all kinds of new balances has to be worked out. Well, I just get this land because I fence it. Well, you couldn't just do that in Europe, but suddenly you could do that kind of thing here. And then the issue became, you know, the wildlife. Well, I have free access to it and so on and so forth. And in the early days, that's the way it had to be. But they began even fairly soon in the local environments of colonies to find out that they could quickly denude the landscape of wildlife if they tried, and because they had to rely on it. And there were, in fact, some very early attempts, amazingly so, in this country for kind of restrictive local game laws that didn't amount to much.
Yeah, didn't they always would beat up against Manifest Destiny or some idea that, you know, we're just going to blow through this.
Well, you certainly couldn't control, you know. Yeah. The idea of control, as I said last night in discussions here in the city, in the town, you know, that was not really on the agenda. But eventually what would take place is that there would be a challenge of this, dealing with the harvest of oysters, actually, in a river system. where the issue came up before the courts to say whether or not somebody could essentially own that particular resource in that particular location and exclude others sort of from it. So this was the wild takings. And there was established a law at the time that said no, that these resources reside in the public trust. And one can question why the court would have rendered that decision, but of course courts themselves are the products of cultural circumstances, and in the circumstance of the new world and the new opportunity and the new way of doing things, there certainly was a reluctance to go back to something that would mirror or to create something that would mirror the often more exclusionary policies and laws of Europe with respect to access to wildlife. And the only way out of that was to essentially say, you know, it will be for everyone, which, as we know, for a significant period of time, meant that wildlife became vulnerable because that idea also made it much more difficult to constrain people, right? And that eventually is what led us to the point where ultimately the great revolution in how we would deal with wildlife and all the other, you know, fair chase hunting and application of science, other principles you will come to, how they eventually emerged. But the foundational principle of all, and what is considered the most sacred foundational principle for North American conservation, and remember, Canada and the United States joined in this model, which itself is something we might talk about because that was a phenomenon, was that no one owns wild things. And this had precedence in many historical laws, including the idea of res nullius in Roman law, for example, which had essentially said the same thing. It's owned by no one until you possess it, until you harvest it, for example. And there were traceable other issues of law and jurisprudence that the famous case of Martin versus Waddell, which was the case that I refer to in the Supreme Court with Chief Justice Taney residing, that eventually led to the proclamation that this was going to be a public trust resource. There were linkages with Magna Carta, and there were linkages with Roman law. So I'm not saying that they didn't borrow from international institutions and policies, but ultimately they created a system here which really did enshrine this notion that every citizen of Canada and the United States equally owns, although no one really owns, wild things.
Yeah, and a complicated idea to explain, right?
Yeah, of course.
Thing that bangs up again. I own the land, but don't I own the wildlife?
Right, exactly. And this is, and that's a really important point that you raised there, because of course, private property rights in the United States and Canada, but especially in this country, the United States, have been foundational to the economic stability, growth, and prosperity of this nation. So, and that is also, I would say, considered an absolutely inviolate principle of Americanism.
Yes, sir.
And yet, as you point out, we had to deal with the fact that, okay, I own this land, I've fenced it, I've probably, you know, produced it or cultivated it and done all kinds of great things, but a deer pops in or a bear comes in or whatever might come in, they're right there on my land, but I do not own them.
Yeah.
That's a powerful thing for a country to have been able to lay down in very early days.
Yeah.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at OReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's OReillyAuto.com/meateater. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
We've seen that in the, you know, the more this all these tenants kind of open up these rabbit holes that we can charge down, but we've seen that in kind of the modern parlance around public lands. You know,
yes.
You know, Utah is a huge bastion for state transfer. And folks there, Orrin Hatch and among them and others, have called back to the Homestead Act. Like, it's America's right to go and grab up this land and own it and profit from it, right? That being this deeply held ideal that, mm-hmm. that we have as a country. Using that as a way to say that public lands are go against... public lands are some sort of aristocracy. In reverse, right? So we've run up these two core ideals have kind of run up against each other. I'm sure they always have,
yes.
But they have, you know, even in recent times, the folks that are listening to this have only been in our hunting community for a short time. They may, you know, may be aware of the public land issue, and I think it, you know, and it's relevant now because there are people that, homesteading and the ownership of land is and privatization of land is a huge issue.
It is.
And when we throw that up against the public resource of wildlife, it's to this day entangled. And I imagine we'll remain tangled on a micro level. On the macro level, I think we all agree with it, but on a micro level, when you create a habitat and you pay to have it created in a wildlife, migrates or is now on your property, you know, there's got to be a little bit of a, in your own mind, there has to be a little bit of a pushback to the idea that that's a public resource.
And there is, and that opens up all these new things that had to be added, compensation and relocation of wildlife and rightfully so, protecting landowners' rights and crops and so on and so forth. And yet through all of that confusion and conflict and, you know, it's like it's complex things are constantly giving birth, right? Mm-hmm. Complex things are constantly giving birth. And so one issue arises, you grapple with it, but another one spins off from there and another one spins off from there. The model, however, which is important in this context, because of its structure, that it had an architecture, allows us to work through those problems and develop solutions that yet remain within the confines of that model.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we didn't say... Oh, in the case, let's say, of agricultural depredation by wildlife, we didn't then turn around and say when that became a significant problem, okay, that's an exception to the model. Yes. You own them now because yes. That's how we're going to deal with that. We didn't. We searched for solutions that allowed us to keep public trust and other principles of the model intact. And a lot of people do not understand that. that the model's principles were guiding so many things, setting limits on so many other policy and institutional decisions, that we have found our way through and done some amazingly creative things, particularly in this country with things like the Farm Bill and other things. But the policies were developed in a framework that had to consider the architecture of the model.
Yeah, that's what we're back to in the beginning, where you set this base, this model, this thing to work within.
Yeah.
And you can, and we will continue to shift ourselves around inside of that model.
Yes.
But not straying from it is an important, you know, important construct for what we're talking about here. And for us as individuals and us as a collective, I would think. So the next one, and again, these all play well together. The next one is the elimination of markets for game. I think folks are probably more familiar with that just based on, you know, it being common history, market hunting. But take us through kind of the thought process leading to that one.
Well, you know, there were, as I said, even long before the late, 19th and early 20th centuries, there were individual efforts in the part of individual states and even colonial governments, in some cases, to pass laws of restriction, laws of limitation on how we would harvest wildlife. But of course, there were so many compelling reasons, practical and ideological, that led the American colonists to believe that it was his, her right, and indeed his, her duty practically, to dominate the land and to move wildlife off and to create the kind of Jeffersonian America that for a long time prevailed and still echoes in the American psyche, the private family farm, you know, work hard, improve things and prosper. But despite those pressures to stay the course and religious instruction that man shall have dominion, which played out a great deal as well, matters of faith influenced this approach. It soon began to become clear to everyone that this incredible wealth was disappearing. We had rivers that at previous times, perhaps only decades before, had runs of anadromous fish, you know, such as salmon, for example, that literally clogged the waterways. You could almost walk across the rivers on their backs. You had in the coastal waters flotillas of lobsters that were sometimes 3 and 4 feet deep during spawning time that people could examine and so on. In other words, it just became obvious to the average person what was happening. And at the same time, you then had the growth in the eastern cities of, you know, elites who had time, more time to reflect, the idea of newspapers bringing arguments. So the telegraph began to spread the word through wider regions. And suddenly you had, you know, a couple of really iconic things happened. First of all, you had the passenger pigeon. Certainly the most numerous bird species on Earth at the time. An animal that would, you know, form flocks in some cases of a billion or more animals. That would take in some cases 3, 4 to 5 days to pass over a single locale. So a farmsteading family would see here hours before the birds would come the distant thunder of their wing beats and then be plunged into essential darkness for days and rained upon with guano that fell in the tons from the passage of these birds and the din of the wind that came from them. These experiences were so strong that they entered the world of mysticism, and people believed, in some cases, fell on their knees and said that they truly believed this was the end of the world. They could not imagine this thing. It was beyond the limits of their imagination. And then suddenly, in a relatively short period of time, they were gone. And then finally, it was reported, of course, that the last of the kind, Martha, the last of her kind, died in the Cincinnati Zoo, and they were gone forever. And the second thing, I believe, was the American bison.
Yeah.
The slaughter that eventually went from simply taking them for product for the meat and for the hides and so on, eventually descended through a combination of determined and and purposeful strategy by the American government to starve out the remaining Plains Indians who would not subdue to American European expansion, culminated with a massive rise in the marketing of the pelts and the hides for machinery purposes in Europe and also for clothing and various other things that were interested, but came down to the point where highly specialized individuals were essentially killing them just for their robes and often just for their tongues, and leaving, you know, these fields of rotting carcasses gleaming white with the fat on their backs as far as the eye could see. And, of course, this was now being seen by more people because, of course, the railways themselves made it possible for those people to do that and get their hides back to ports in Missouri or other places where they could be shipped and eventually tanned and presented to Europe. More and more people saw it, journalists saw it, and eventually people were simply appalled by the scale of the destruction. And that really began to set in motion, as well as nourish, the already existing fear and concern that forward-thinking people like George Bird Grinnell, editor of Forest and Stream, the forerunner of Field and Stream, of course, editor for almost 40 years there, a constant agitator for social progress in the world of conservation. The formation of groups like the Boone and Crockett Club in 1887 and like the Sierra Club some 15 or 20 so years later, 10 years later, you started to get the growth of not only, magazines and the social media of the day to complain about this. It finally came to the point where people said, enough is enough. The incredible thing about that, however, that a lot of people, even students of the model, do not emphasize or perhaps in some cases do not even recognize, is the genius in the approach of this. Let us imagine that today we are faced with the denuding of wildlife across the United States of America at a scale where pronghorn antelope, white-tailed deer, wood duck, Canada geese, mule deer, elk, black bear, grizzly bear, wild turkey, name the iconic,
our favorite,
visible species.
Our favorite critters.
Yeah. Are just being absolutely denuded from the land. And we know that the reason they're being denuded from the land is that people are killing them. People are hunting them to extinction. It would seem logical that the response to that might be, okay, the problem is the killing of them. The problem is the hunting of them. Therefore, we are ending all hunting, all killing of these animals, at least for a period of time. Some sort of moratorium, at least, is going to take place here. What the architects of the North American model did, and there were many of them, we refer to Roosevelt and a few others, of course, because they did a great job of promoting themselves even while alive, but they also did great things.
Yes.
What they did was say, no, we are actually going to make the harvesting of them the secret to their recovery.
Yeah.
This really was, in my view, an act of genius.
Yeah, so the introduction, well, it could be seen as the introduction of sustainability
totally
around the model. Right?
It was.
Yes.
This is where this idea that you no longer would be able to take an animal and market its dead body and its parts, its meat, et cetera, for your own personal gain. So your motivation was not for that. Your motivation would have been to engage in hunting because of other reasons, cultural, the sportsman's life, et cetera, and for food and for your own individual consumption.
Yeah.
That would be okay. But the marketing of dead wildlife essentially came to an end. And then, of course, we had some of the most important pieces of legislation in the United States introduced that really gave us laws by which to control
them. Yeah, I mean the Lacey Act.
Yes,
being the
predominant and the most and absolutely the most influential, and that was 1908, I think.
Yeah, around there. Then the Migratory Bird Act.
Yes,
did some work on the international level as well.
Yeah. And that opens up, and that's a really important thing you open up there as well, because while we think about the hunted species hunted for their hides and meat, one of the most egregious virulent and intensive market hunting that was occurring was focused on shorebirds and colonial nesting birds. And in particular, the birds of the long feathers, as we would call them, the herons and the egrets and so on and so forth. At the time, the first decade of the 20th century, a pound of egret's feathers was worth more than a pound of gold. That's a historical fact. And so massive destruction of breeding colonies took place. You know, while the birds were nesting, it was the time to get them together. They were there in the trees. It was easy to get up and kill them with muzzle loaders and so on and so forth. In large numbers, the eggs and chicks would be abandoned. Whole colonies would collapse. And while Roosevelt himself and George Bird Grinnell in particular, the man who founded the Audubon Society, ultimately, railed against this, no pun intended, they also linked up with a very non-traditional movement, I suppose, at the time, which was the women's movement that at that time was actively campaigning for the vote, the yes. suffrage movement.
Yes.
The bird feathers were used fundamentally to adorn women's hats. This was a massive fashion craze, and the more feathers you had, the better. And it reached the scale at which the nests themselves were actually placed in the hats. And so women of high fashion wow. used this, both in Europe and in the United States. And of course, we had these unlimited, in quotation marks, mm-hmm. colonies. And so we were feeding that. What eventually destroyed that market, what eventually forced that market out of existence, a market we couldn't even imagine today, could we?
No, I could not. If somebody was walking around with a nest on their head, I'd probably have something to say.
Yeah, and so, but it was the women of society in particular who ended that by making it simply unacceptable to come into a salon or to a party wearing something like it.
Yeah.
And so this was one of the first interjections in a coordinated way by women in the conservation effort in America, and one of the most important things that could have possibly have been done, because we would have lost, unquestionably, as we did the passenger pigeon, many, many, many species of that kind of the wading birds, except for the fact that women can join their condemnation of it with the rising, often more patriarchal movement in society of men's groups, you know, hunting yeah. groups that yeah. were working on this thing.
Yeah, you make a good point. Again, this could go for a long time, this particular one, but you make a good point around, you know, the women who were taking part in this practice being the ones to, you know, force it out.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't allow it in the party, then it doesn't become desirable anymore, then it goes away.
Yeah.
I think you could very much apply that to a lot of things going on in the hunting space right now.
You certainly could.
If we were willing to or had the forethought to eliminate, you know, to treat some things we're doing in that manner to look towards the future and say, if we eliminate this now, we're going to be better off in the future.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that quietly and unexpectedly women created almost out of nowhere a forceful movement that really was exceptional because nobody was supporting it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't part of the normal channels in society at the time. And yet, I mean, they focused on this problem. And they figured very quickly how to solve it. And they weren't waiting around for laws and, legislation to be passed, although that eventually was. They simply made it unacceptable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That was it.
It's some good learning in
yep.
there. So the next one, I feel like we covered that one. I feel like we covered that one pretty good. A lot of folks, I think, in the more modern sense, understand the Lacey Act and that a lot of people are charged with federal crimes when they do things illegal from state to state. I think it's good to think of it in this context. When you guys are thinking about the Lacey Act or the Migratory Bird Act, think about it in this context as well as the more modern sense of how it's being implemented.
Yeah, I mean, it was a rescue for this problem,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
If we didn't have it, then people just escape to another state, essentially.
Right? Keep doing it.
Yeah.
Keep doing it.
Yeah.
The next one here, number three, the allocation of wildlife by law.
Mm-hmm.
Again, similar to number two, but take us kind of through how this became?
Well, of course, initially there were no laws governing the taking of wildlife at all.
Yeah, actually, my dad. We're going to answer something specifically for my dad because he will listen to this. He did, and feel free to get to this as you explain this. But he asked me, like, when was the first game law passed? When did the first person have to buy a license? And I didn't really know the answer to it.
Well, as I said, there were actually some extremely early game laws and so on, even in the colonies, that came out limiting during a certain season. You couldn't take deer, or you could only take too many, and you couldn't do things during the nesting season and so on. There was a sprinkling of them, and there weren't few. There's many of them, but of course they didn't really have an impact because, of course, while they had a certain level of justice that, one also had to understand that very often those laws had to be set aside because people were starving or, they didn't find enough Indian corn to steal or whatever the circumstance might have been. So the idea that wildlife would be allocated by law became, a gradually spreading kind of notion because you had mostly in the 1900s, but in some cases earlier than that, but mostly in the 1900s, you had the growth, of course, of these kinds of, as the cities in the East expanded, these kinds of shooting and hunting clubs, often duck clubs, and so on and so forth, where people would go out and either purchase or lease, significant amounts of land that were often marshland, places where waterfowl would come, and they would form laws for their club. So if Ben and Shane were going to be a part of the Bozeman Waterfowlers Club, then we would have to agree to abide by the various limits. There'd be no hunting in these seasons. We'd let the ducklings.
Yeah, a more communal way of approaching it. Yeah.
And they were really, they weren't state statutes at the time. They were more local, county, or actual club membership kind of voluntary laws, if you know what I mean. But eventually it clearly became necessary after we started to realize that the excessive take could not be tolerated. And we also decided that we would still allow people to harvest wildlife. Then clearly there now had to be limits. Mm. We had to prescribe how that could be done. We couldn't just say no more market hunting, but yet you can go and do the following. We had to have a system of prescriptions, laws essentially, that would say what would be appropriate. And they pertain to things such as take, how many ducks or how many deer, seasons, of course, when you could do this. And there was always an objection about, killing animals during the breeding season or killing animals when they had young early or were nesting and so on and so forth. They were kind of common sense approaches. And there were also laws, of course, that talked about how you could do this, even in the season in which you could do it, which was where many of the notions around fair chase and appropriate take were introduced. Now, it's important to realize that while many of these things were endemic, in a sense, to the United States and to Canada, because parallel things were going on in the country to the north, that did not mean that there was not European influence on these things. And in fact, if perhaps the most classic example of that is fair chase. Fair chase is not an American creation. Fair chase is not a creation of the Boone and Crockett Club. Fair chase was introduced to America by primarily European writers and European sportsmen, in quotation marks, including amongst the most famous, a man by the name of Frank Forrester, which was his pen name, who was a wealthy aristocrat from Europe who came here and talked and wrote a lot about hunting and the aggressive life, the sportsman's life here. And there, he and others were very influential in ideas such as you don't shoot a bird on the water, or you would never shoot a bird on its nest, or you would never run an animal into deep snow to kill it, or just all those kinds of basic, reasonable, respectful, codified things. So those kinds of things were in the law too. How much you could take, when you could take it, and how you could actually take it. These were all pretty early prescriptions. And if you think about it, they remain pretty much the kind of prescriptions that we still have 120 years later. Right?
It's pretty unbelievable. I mean, when you think about, what are the kinds of things, when you say allocation by law, what are the other things that they could be allocated by? We've kind of covered some of them. Private land ownership, by markets, allocated by like how many.
How much can be stand?
Yeah, how much can we stand? You know, it's all these other ways that you might allocate wildlife we've kind of covered. But now now when you get into how do we, you know, provide concretia to some of these ideas, and it's by putting them into law. And it's, man, it's interesting how fair chase or those kind of like ethical principles rose out of the need to codify these and make them laws.
Yes. That's pretty amazing. And also, I think another really significant issue is in today's world, there are, of course, strong movements to try and give more and more autonomy and governance over wildlife use to communities in many parts of the world. Mm. This is a major thrust for the United Nations, for the World Conservation Unions, the World Wildlife Funds, you know, the big international NGOs, as well as world governments, the EU in particular. And I deal with this on a regular basis in my work with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. This is a very consistent, powerful narrative now in conservation. And so what is interesting in this regard, as we seek solutions and see great value in devolving wildlife management rights to communities in many, many parts of the world. Interestingly, in the most capitalistic, democratic of nations, the United States and pretty close follower in Canada, we create the most state-driven, state-operated, state-directed conservation model, right? And so the laws of how it would be done and the laws of no one owns wildlife all protected or moved away from or did not involve the idea of giving over to counties or, you know, towns or cities or whatever the right to sort of take over the wildlife in some.
Yeah, and that's directly. Yeah, we're saying you don't own this.
No,
because
no.
Your proximity doesn't dictate your ownership of the thing.
But there's a major movement around the world. Indeed, it's viewed as one of the ways of saving wildlife in other parts.
Wow, we were just covering the hunting for the markhor in Pakistan, and they have this community based conservancies where these local communities are fighting with each other to get the hunter to come in and give them the money. Which it seems like a strange, but it's still propelling them to maybe the right end. But again, rabbit hole.
But it is, and not all is perfect with that system either, of course. But I think what is really unique is that one of the most robust, longest standing, certainly, and most highly effective conservation mechanisms in the world, in Canada and the United States, is completely. Lies completely outside of giving local communities, you know, their own, if you will.
Yeah.
And I constantly bring this forward in the discussions that, you know, when you talk about this as this community-based resource management approach as sort of the panacea, please remember, you have these two massive countries, you know, in the, you know, between the Pacific and the Atlantic, ran a very early experiment 100 years ago.
It's been working. We're doing pretty good with it.
So that's also interesting to point out.
You know? And it goes back to the democracy of wildlife and some of those ideas.
Yes.
That we really do have a democracy of wildlife, and those more international community based things become aristocracies.
Yep.
Whether it's by consequence or how that becomes, they become aristocracies because it's a small number of people funding, you know, that are hunting these animals and funding it in a way that just isn't acceptable here. Wouldn't be acceptable here.
But also, I don't know that they're becoming aristocracies as such, but what is similar to our history is that they have a crisis of wildlife depletion,
they
have to search for a solution.
Yeah.
And we can't transpose ours on them any more than we can transpose, as I tell them, theirs on ours. Yeah. I mean, if tomorrow I came back from, you know, a major global conference and met with, lawmakers in Ottawa and in Washington and said, you know, now I think what we ought to do is, you know, really bring community-based wildlife management to the fore in Canada and the United States. I think you and your listeners can imagine what that would do.
Yeah. I mean, there's a hunting, you know, versus values type of idea there.
Like
hunting creates value in that international sense now.
Yeah.
Whereas here, we have the value.
The value is here already.
It's almost like the value created the privilege of hunting. Like the value is kind of manifested some way in the hunting in this model in some way. So I think that's another great thing to understand. I think, like, as we break down this model, I think these first three are kind of like, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
I almost would have been like, we could stop here.
Yeah.
This simplifies it. But you guys kept going. And I think once you get to the end, you start to realize kind of why. That's it. That is all. Thanks to Shane Mahoney for this conversation. Obviously, this is part one of a two-part conversation that we've had. Remember that. But this part one holds within it a few jewels of the history of the North American model. And I think if I take away from this part of the conversation, the story of how it was conceived. So when we talk about CWD in the modern day, we talk about high fence captive wildlife operations. We can know that some of those leanings were built into Dr. Valerius Geist's thought process around this model when he first wrote it down. And that's huge. And then also we learn about how Shane helped to market and promote the ideas that he helped to codify with Dr. Geist. So a huge piece of the history of the hunting world is covered here. In the next episode, next Tuesday, we're going to cover the rest of the model, which includes a lot of important topics. We're going to get into challenges over time that this model has faced. We're going to get into what the hunting world needs to understand about going forward with this model, some of the conflicts that will arise, and really Shane's core beliefs as to how the hunting community can carry forward in society and maintain its relevance, which is a captivating piece of conversational history in this podcast. I mean, I think it's probably the most interesting stuff that we've recorded in the many hours that we've recorded. So as you can tell, I'm excited about it. And I wanted to cut it up into two pieces for that reason. I think it should be taken in parts and bits and pieces. So we will cut it up and give you the next piece this coming Tuesday. Hopefully you come back for that. What else? Man, we got a lot going on. We're going to be coming. I'm going to be at the Portland live show. That sucker is sold out. So if you didn't get your tickets, I'm sorry. But if you did get your tickets, I'll be there. And hopefully that adds to your experience. Hopefully you can come hang out, come shake hands, come see us, and then have a good laugh with us while during the show. I really enjoy doing the Meat Eater Live podcast, and I'm privileged that Mr. Ranella has allowed me to join for so many. I think that's it for now. Enjoy, and we will see you next week for the continued part two of this conversation with Shane Mahoney on the North American model here on the Hunting Collective. Thanks, and bye-bye.
Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. Hey, everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right. Join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's going to be there. Phil the Engineer is going to be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th. The Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25, the Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27, the Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29, the Union in Salt Lake City. April 30, the Egyptian in Boise. May 1, the Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2, the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at themeateater.com. Hope to see you at the show.